people have got into what we call the spiral of doom. So you don't say anything at all because you're afraid of the impact. So you squash it down, you don't say anything. And then finally, you can't take it anymore. So you speak up and you let them have it. And you let them have it in the worst way possible, with the worst language possible, with the worst body language possible. And guess what? They don't react well. So now you've got proof that speaking up is dangerous. So you don't speak up anymore. You go speechless again. And that's the spiral of doom.
From MyFM, I'm Chirag, and you're listening to Tales of the Trade, a show that tells you the stories of Dubai's entrepreneurs and changemakers, and the companies and communities that they brought to life. Now, a few weeks ago, we had a milestone of our own. We held our first show in front of a live audience. And although we thoroughly enjoyed the here and now-ness of a live show, and we hope to have another one in the books later this year, these conversations are just too power-packed to not be on the record. And so here we are, sharing these conversations with you. And for those of you who missed our maiden live event, you're in for a treat. I sat down with Don Metcalf, the founder of PDSI, a Dubai-based corporate training, advisory, and coaching company, which he founded in 2010. She's also the author of two books, Managing the Matrix and the Hard Talk Handbook, which acts as a foundation for her extremely popular Hard Talk program. Don's tale is one that brought to light the power of networking, but with a healthy side serving of humor and some straight talk. So pull up a chair and join our conversation. Now, before she came to Dubai, Dawn's journey spanned several countries, growing up in Ireland and the UK, and then working in Japan. But at some point, she decided she wanted to move to China, thanks to Chairman Mao.
Because of the cult of personality, because of this idea that there's this one person who can get almost a billion people to do things. And how on earth did he do that? And he did make them do almost everything. The only thing that Mao didn't manage to make the Chinese do was stop spitting. Because nobody's ever been able to do that.
So Don walked over to the offices of the VSO, the Voluntary Service Overseas, an organization in the UK similar to the Peace Corps.
Knocked on the door and said, hello, I'd like to go to the middle of nowhere in China, please, and I'd like to go all by myself. And I've already had 3 years experience teaching and working in Japan. And they said, yeah, all right, idiot, sign this piece of paper now before you change your mind. So I ended up going to a place called Gansu, which is north, north, north of China, right on the desert, about 14 hours north of Xi'an. I was the third foreigner in the history of the world to live in this city, a town of a million people. I was the first female foreigner in the history of the world to live in this city, and I was the only foreigner for 14 hours in any direction, the only person who wasn't Chinese. But it was quite something. I was there when NATO bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And the Chinese got very, very upset.
Which they took out on you?
Not deliberately. So if you were in the West, if you were in Beijing or Shanghai, there were embassies and consulates. So that's where the demonstrations were. And as you moved further westward, there was KFC and McDonald's, and that's where the demonstrations were. But when you got to where I lived, there was nothing, absolutely nothing. I was the foreign thing. So there were 5,000 very angry Chinese people outside my apartment, shouting down with NATO, with placards and the whole thing, you know, with the red headbands, and me sitting inside thinking, this is dodgy. This is quite dodgy. And of course, it's pre-internet. So, I mean, the internet existed, but not widely. I had access to the internet for an hour a week.
And this went on for how long?
The demonstrations went on for a while, not too long. But at the same time, my boss had decided that he, quote unquote, liked me and decided to make that liking apparent. So in 1 week, I had to deal with sexual harassment and demonstrations. So after about 24 hours of both, I decided, no, I was going on a holiday. So I put myself onto a bus and went down to Xi'an and hung out with some friends and just got the hell out of Dodge, really.
And then, did you leave China immediately after that?
No, I didn't. I moved down to Changsha, which was actually, I ended up teaching in a school that Chairman Mao had gone to. And I was about 2.5 hours from his hometown, Shaoshan.
Which was the point of this
Which was the point of the whole thing. But when I actually went to visit his town, and it's this ridiculous tourist trap for Chinese. And you realize that Chairman Mao was not a peasant, right? So he set himself up, the whole origin story was a peasant. But he wasn't a peasant, and you can tell that because in the house, he had two walks, and one was for people and one was for pigs. And that's how you knew you were middle class at that stage in China's development. It was a peculiar time.
Don finally left China in 1999. She spent some time in Thailand and the States before returning to the UK to teach.
I was teaching in a very challenging school and was on the fast track to becoming a head teacher. And then suddenly I got ill. I got a disease called psoriasis, which is a skin thing. And then a certain percentage of people who get psoriasis get a disease called psoriatic arthritis. So like rheumatoid arthritis, that kind of autoimmune disease. So I got very, very ill. And for a year, I was horribly ill. I wasn't sure if I'd ever walk again. I was pretty sure I'd never work again. And I got some great drugs. They may be a lot better. I'm still on them, touch wood, they're still working. But I wasn't going to work in that kind of environment again. So I made the jump into the private sector and ended up working for a small management consulting firm, working for their learning and development department, building that. And then I brought them over here in 2008, on the day that the recession started. Yay!
2008, the world economy had started to reel under the mortgage crisis in the US, among other things. In fact, I'd returned to Dubai just the year before that, and the news was filled with institutions like AIG and Bear Stearns and Fannie Mae falling apart. Dubai, being the international hub that it is, was not immune.
And I was so naive that I believed that when everybody said, oh, my business is doing fine, that they meant it. So I couldn't work out why my business was so awful. And it took about a year or two to realize, oh, no, people were just, you know, fronting up.
So what made you sort of shift from... because you were doing trainings as well at the time, right?
What is it they say in the music business? Creative differences? I had creative differences with my previous organization. I'm very clear that I want to behave in a way that allows me to look at myself in the mirror in the morning and not feel bad. I want to be able to pick up the telephone and not worry about what's going to be said on the other end. When the email goes ping, I want to know that it's not going to be somebody saying, I don't think you've behaved properly. Or if they do think I've behaved properly, I know that I've behaved properly by my own lights. So I wanted to run my own show.
But that was the kind of environment you were in where it was...
I think, as I said, creative differences. I wasn't convinced that the business was going in the way that I wanted it to. And look, it's hard. It's hard to be an entrepreneur. It's hard to be a small business owner. And when somebody goes, well, what about this shiny thing? And you think, oh, maybe that shiny thing might actually be, you know, profitable. It's very hard to say no to it. But I'm kind of... we're trying to stay very, very focused on what we're good at.
But this is something that comes up a lot as well, like when you're talking about focus. When I'm, you know, obviously talking to a lot of entrepreneurs and stuff, and that's something that they find it very hard to do, partly because, oh, shiny, let me dabble into that as well. Oh, and sometimes you feel like it's a trend problem. So you think like, oh, this is trending and it's close enough to my business that I should jump into it.
Yeah.
How do you try and differentiate? Because there are some trends you do need to jump on, though.
Well, absolutely. But so, for example, there's a very buzzy word at the moment around transformation. Right, which is another way of saying change. And we've been dealing with change for years, so I'm perfectly comfortable saying that we help with transformation. But I'm not going to say that we're experts in AI or that suddenly we're experts in Bitcoin. You know, apparently if you put the name Bitcoin on your business is immediately 3 times more valuable. This is what the statistics show. Still not prepared to do it. I don't know anything about Bitcoin, except I don't know anything about Bitcoin.
In 2010 anyway, so you launched, what was the initial, the first couple of years like?
It was actually marvelous. The first week was amazing. The first day was amazing. So I left Ireland when I was 17, so approximately 100 years ago now. And you should look more shocked by that, Chirag. That's a little bit rude.
Only because I've heard you say this many times.
Thank you. So I went, having left Ireland at 17, I never did anything Irish. I never went to Irish networks, never did anything like that. And the day I set up my own business, I walked into the Irish Business Network and went, hello, Bajiz Bagar and how are you, lads? Would you ever help a fellow Irish woman out? And they did. I was lucky enough to meet the head of one of the largest lines of service for one of the largest professional services firms in the region, in the world, and managed to meet him on the right day. He was looking for somebody who could help develop some training. So I ended up developing some training for their partners, directors, and senior managers across the whole region. And it was phenomenal. And this week, I still have them as clients. I was working with them this week.
This first customer had a ripple effect for PDSI, giving them the right impetus from week one. And the business was built step by step via solid recommendations. But as with any business, there are pain points and challenges. And Dawn has her own entrepreneurial way of dealing with them.
I had a day 3.5 weeks ago where I wanted to shut down the business and be done with the whole lot of you. By which I mean people. Like, I just, no, enough now. It was a really bad day. 3 or 4 or 5 different things happened and they all coalesced at the same time and it was miserable. And it was, I went to bed for the weekend. which is my go-to. I know you're supposed to say that you go running or that you do yoga or that you reflect on all the good things. I didn't. I went to bed for the weekend. I had a long bath and I went to bed for the weekend.
I can't imagine that was the only bad time you had. I'm sure there were many over the course of nearly 10 years now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, few as bad as that one. The only other one that I can think of that was as bad, I went to bed for the weekend. No, I called my dad and then I went to bed for the weekend. And by the way, when I woke up on the Sunday, the client who had made it a disaster had fixed the problem. So sometimes going to bed for the weekend is the answer. I mean,
I'm sorry, but what you're telling us now is that the solution to problems in entrepreneurship is like just hide until the problem goes
away. Well, I mean, no, but sometimes it is just accept there's nothing you can do right now and just give yourself a break. You know, go and read Terry Pratchett in the bath. I might be oversharing right now, but that's exactly what I did. There's some stuff you can do and there's some stuff you can't. And there's stuff that you can do right now and there's stuff that has to wait. My diary is like my calendar, my online calendar. That's where everything goes. Any idea I have, anything that needs to be done, it goes in there. And if it can't be done this week, it just gets moved. But it will always get done eventually. But you never know what's going to come up. You know, I think right now that next Sunday and Monday are going to be days where I sit down and I get things done. If a client calls tomorrow, that might change. So the stuff that is a priority right now might change. I'm very pragmatic.
I'll leave that for the audience to decide. I'm not making any judgments today. Obviously, you had a great, like I said, you had a great first week. You got connected with the right set of people, which it offers you a different kind of flexibility, obviously, if you're profitable from the beginning.
It does. But I think meeting the right people is one thing. The other thing is creating a relationship with those people and keeping that relationship going. And that relationship not being transactional, but it being a genuine relationship. So when people say to me they hate networking, I say, well, that's because you're not doing it right. If you're thinking of networking as going out and going, here, have a business card, here, have a business card, here, what can I do for you? How can I sell you things? Then of course you're going to hate networking. It's miserable. But if you see networking as an opportunity to go out and find ways of helping other people, then it becomes a joy. And if you do that with real, true sincerity, people feel that. And 5 years later, 7 years later, they'll get back in touch. It literally happened 2 hours ago. I had a phone call from a guy that I met 5 years ago. He's an exec search guy. I had forgotten I knew him. And he got in touch and he said, I've got this issue. I've got this person that needs help. Can somebody on your team help? Yes, they can. And they're talking as we speak. They're talking. So those relationships, I think, are important.
When you hit the point pretty well, which is you said, you know, you invest in it and 5 years later you'll see results. I don't think people have the patience to wait 5 years anymore.
I don't know what to tell you. Sometimes it takes that long. We brought Hard Talk to the market and it's going great. It's going really well. Is it going as well as I would like it to? No, of course not. You know, ideally we would have taken over the world by now. But ultimately, we're here for the long term. We're here for good, you know? So we can afford to wait. We can afford to not constantly knock on clients' door going, do you want us yet? Do you want us yet? Do you want us yet? We're not the most important person in their lives, right? So we need to be there when they're ready for us. They need to remember that we exist, which is, you know, why we stay in touch and why we try and help. But ultimately, you can't force people to sign up. You can't force people to put their hands in their pockets. It has to be the right time for them as well as you. And, you know, we're on the outside. We don't know what's going on with them internally. We can't take it personally.
What were you doing differently? Do you think there was something that you guys did that made you successful?
I think we were unbelievably honest all the time. So if somebody got in touch and said, can you do this? And we couldn't, we would just say no. And we would try and help them to find somebody. The other thing we did was we never invoiced until after we'd done the work. I know, shocking, right?
Well, yes, but that probably because you were profitable from the beginning. And
we were able to do that, yeah.
Because I think a lot of startups, they don't have that luxury. Cash flow is a huge issue.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. We were lucky, but it was also, it's a great differentiator, right? So we're selling a service that's intangible and people are saying, well, how do we know you're going to be good? It's like, okay, well, here's our references. You know, we were talking to you because somebody recommended us. That's number one. Number two, we've been here for a while now, so we must be doing something right. But number three, tell you what, don't pay us. Don't pay us until we've proved ourselves, and then pay us all of it the day after we have done. And we've never, ever not been paid.
We're going to delve a bit more into Dawn's focus on the Hard Talk program and her thoughts on entrepreneurship right after this. Stay with us.
Feel like your favorite platforms have become a place for toxicity and fake lifestyles? We invite you to listen to CSR of One, a podcast that explores the proactive side of social media. In a world full of selfies, we challenge you to do more. Do something. Help someone. Use your place in the world for those who don't have a voice. The first season of CSR of One is now live wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Chirag, and you're listening to Tales of the Trade with our guest, Dawn Metcalf. Now, by 2017, Dawn had already written her first book, Managing the Matrix. And as PDSI continued assessing companies and training people, she started noticing some familiar things come up at these organizations. On top of that, most corporate trainings are imported here, and therefore quite limited when it came to regional and cross-cultural workplaces. Having difficult conversations, hard as they already are, was just further complicated by Dubai being such a cultural melting pot.
One of the things that became clear in Managing the Matrix was that it's very easy for people to fall through the cracks in a matrix organization. And by definition, almost all MNCs or multinationals are matrices. So accountability is a very big deal. And if you're in a matrix organization, you're often having to hold people accountable who are not your direct reports. So it becomes even more of a big deal. The second reason that it was always important to me was how to communicate effectively. Remember, I've lived in England, France, Spain, Japan, China, Thailand, the UK again, and then here, the most multinational place on the planet. So how to communicate across cultures has always been interesting to me. And then the third reason was I was delivering a similar program that didn't belong to us in Abu Dhabi for many years. And it was a good program, it really was. But it was built by Americans for Americans. And it just did not acknowledge that the rest of the world existed. It had no idea how to deal with the multicultural stuff that we deal with every day. So Hard Talk was built to deal with that.
So the program came first, and then you started working on the book in parallel?
I was really lucky. I had a client who allowed me to build this training program and then deliver it to them when it was still very, very raw, and gave me feedback. They were all trainers. They gave me this goldest feedback, which then allowed me to go away and develop it properly. And then ultimately, as soon as the training program was ready to go, I started to write the book. It was a lot easier to write the second book than it was the first.
Was there a reason why you decided to take an approach of writing a book around this?
Yeah, because not everybody's going to be able to have the training program. And even those who do have the training program, even though we've really worked very hard involving neuropsychologists and cognitive scientists and all these kind of people to make sure that it's super, super sticky, that once you've been through the program, your behavior does actually change and you do see the world differently. Even then, it's nice to have something that you can refer back to that's not just a workbook.
Hard Talk became Dawn's entire focus for nearly 2 years. She published the Hard Talk Handbook in 2018, which became the foundation point for the program itself, not to mention various speaking engagements. But all of this couldn't come at the cost of PDSI's existing clients. And this is where the team that she's built stepped up.
So I'm very lucky. I've got a team of people that work with me, and they were able to continue working. They continued doing other training and other coaching. And I did a little bit here and there because, you know, there are some clients that have known me for a long time and want me. Although it was, even then, I would talk to people and they'd say, oh no, we want you as a coach, not your people. And it's like, no, you really don't. Because right now I have a hammer and everything looks like a nail. So whatever you think you want to talk about, we are going to end up having to talk about difficult conversations because that's the only thing I have in my head at the moment. So I had to be quite disciplined about that.
The other side of it also is the hiring aspect. You're doing something, you're delivering something that's both intangible, but it's very reliant on the people that are delivering the training. You've got the skills, you've done it, but then when it comes to actually delivering, how do you transfer it down? How do you do that? Like, what has been your process to do this?
So for coaching, it really has been about finding coaches that have been successful elsewhere. Often people who've got their own small businesses, and then we've partnered with them. For our back office, for finance, the CFO of an organization that used to be a customer of ours, he left and set up a business doing back office for SMEs. So that was an easy one. I knew him. We were his first client, and we're still with them. For everybody else, it's a matter of bringing them on. But for me, it's really about attitude first. You can train people on most things if their attitude is right. We're an unusual organization. So the other day we had a performance review that involved me sitting on one sofa in my living room and my colleague sitting on the other sofa in my living room while we chatted and, you know, made notes and then had lunch. It was a very in-depth performance review, but it was very relaxed. We're not terribly formal. It's, for us, it's all about humanity.
Have you had failures with this approach?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, do you think? Yeah, we have. But people talk about failing fast and failing often. So the idea is that we do precisely that. We don't let people out to do harm until we're very, very clear that they're trained. It's actually getting worse now, though, because we're bringing Hard Talk global, which means that we're trying to train facilitators worldwide. And we're doing all of that virtually. And that is tough, because they're going to take my IP, this thing that I've developed over years, and bring it out into their own markets. So we're not taking it quite as a laissez-faire approach on that. It's a long, difficult process for them to get through. It's probably the most difficult process that anybody has in order to get certified to deliver a training program. I've never seen anything as long.
And today, I mean, you've been in this since 2010. How much are you still involved in that process?
Oh, yeah, very.
Entirely?
Yeah. Listen, when I made the jump from public sector to private sector, I was very lucky. I was sent to Harvard to do an exec ed program, and it was called the Leading the Professional Services Firm. And I'll never forget that the first thing, and maybe the biggest message that came through again and again, was that if you are in a professional services firm, your problem is that you have to manage the firm and do the work. And it doesn't matter who you are, right? The biggest law firms in the world, same problem. The partners are out delivering, and they're working on the business. So they're in the business and on the business. It's hard. It's really hard. But I have a little house in Sri Lanka that I run away to, and I do the thinking stuff. And then in Dubai, I'm doing the working stuff, the delivery.
Creating a piece of work, something that is your baby, is a feat in itself. But Hard Talk was designed with an objective to change the very nature of conversation between people.
You really do see change. It's actually quite moving to see the change. I mean, the very first company that we did Hard Talk with, the testimonial the guy gave us, the CEO gave us, was astonishing. He wrote us an 11-paragraph testimonial. We get, you know, messages via LinkedIn or via email telling us the difference that it's made, with people saying, you know, I haven't spoken up to my boss about this, and now I did. And guess what? He didn't bite my head off. He didn't fire me. And it has made a difference. Just this morning, somebody said to me, "But you're not saying we should always have these conversations." And I'm like, "No, I'm not saying that. We're not mad. You know, there is always a cost-benefit analysis. But what we need to do is make sure that we're making the decision, that it's not just the default is I'm frightened, I'm scared of what might happen, and therefore I'm not going to speak up, because there are consequences from not speaking up as well. And one of the pieces of advice that we give in the training is that if you haven't dealt with it directly, if you have left it go a week or 6 months, or in some cases a couple of years, you have to own up to that. You have to say that to the person, "Listen, my bad, I should have said this before." Finding something to apologize for when you're trying to give somebody a difficult message is a really good thing. It's very hard to argue with somebody who's apologizing to you.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry if you don't think so.
What do you see in terms of like these difficult conversations happening between, like at a startup?
Between co-founders. That's the one we hear about all the time. I would think in the last year, we've probably had half a dozen different co-founders get in touch to talk about precisely this. Is we started this thing together. I thought we shared a vision. Oh, we don't. It's become really, really clear. And how do we have that conversation? Oh, it happens a lot. And again, way too often it happens too late. So the people have got into what we call the spiral of doom. So you don't say anything at all because you're afraid of the impact. So you squash it down, you don't say anything. And then finally, you can't take it anymore. So you speak up and you let them have it in the worst way possible, with the worst language possible, with the worst body language possible. And guess what? They don't react well. Of course not. So now you've got proof that speaking up is dangerous. So you don't speak up anymore. You go speechless again. And that's the spiral of doom. You go round and round. Because unless you speak up, nothing changes.
We've talked about entrepreneurship as a concept as well, and how it's changed a lot in the last, maybe let's say 10 years, but of course a little bit longer than that. We grew up, again, as you said, millions of years ago, in an environment where being an entrepreneur was something, first of all, A, it was not something everybody did. And then B, it was something that people did really down the road. You worked for a while and you gained experience and networks and all of this stuff. And then you stepped away and then said, "All right, I'm capable of doing this on my own and I'm going to step away and do it." And today that's not even remotely the norm.
Well, I think that's because what we mean by entrepreneurship has changed so much. Nowadays, if you say entrepreneur, most people think tech. Yeah. Right? And if it's a tech set a startup, then why not be 13 or 14, right? Or 18. If you can code, you can code. If you've got a good idea, you've got a good idea. If you can pitch it to a VC, to a PE, and get some money, go with God, right? But that's not the same thing as running a business. Running a business involves dealing with other people, and that involves a level of maturity that you don't have as a kid, and it's something that is very, very difficult to teach.
But it also means that our training And I don't necessarily mean just corporate training. I mean, a lot of our education systems are still rooted in the same old things anyway, outside of other skills. So how does this gap actually get bridged? I mean, it's just trial and error at the end of the day, and years of people learning things?
Well, look, I'm a great believer in teaching children the best of what we have always known, right? I don't think we should stop teaching children Shakespeare. I don't think we should stop teaching them geography and history. I think people need to learn things, and it is part of their birthright. You and I can sit here and we can reference Churchill and we both know who we mean. That's because of our education system. I don't think we should throw that away. I think we should add more to it. And one of the things I think we should add to it is to help kids bridge that gap, to move from school into the workplace, particularly in the UAE. Well, I don't know about you, but I certainly grew up having part-time jobs. And I learned more in those part-time jobs than I did in anything else that have helped me to succeed in business. That's not the situation these kids are in. So what we're trying to do, and we're just about to launch a new initiative about this, is the Workplace Readiness Program to help students from 15 to 18 to start to learn about the world of work, to move into businesses, and to start to build those relationships, to build those networks, and to build those skills. And we're so excited about it.
But is this something that's, again, we go back to being quantifiable. Like, how do you quantify something like this?
Well, what we'll be doing is we'll be asking the students to quantify themselves, what they think they've learned, but we'll also be getting feedback from the corporates, from the schools, and from their parents. So again, it's about triangulating the different pieces of information so that we've got a fuller picture. But listen, not everything that's worthwhile doing can be measured.
Do you have any regrets?
I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. Not about anything to do with the business, I don't think. You know, it's that old chestnut, as long as you've learned from it. I don't think we've ever made the same mistake twice. When I left uni, I was offered a couple of different corporate jobs. Sometimes I think, oh, maybe I should have taken those. And sometimes I think I should be a little bit more more cynical. So, for example...
Like more cynical?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think I'm cynical. I mean, I did say people suck, which might be a bit cynical.
I hear your teammate is laughing.
No, I think I should be a bit more cynical. Look, when was the last time you heard an author not described as a best-selling author? Every author is a best-selling author. Nobody ever describes me as a best-selling author because we don't describe me as a best-selling author.
You've been an entrepreneur for nearly 10 years. What is balance like for you?
There is no balance, to be ridiculous. Everything is work. Everything is work. But work is everything. I do this because I love it. It doesn't hurt. And when it does hurt, I go to bed. I have a house in Sri Lanka. That's where I go away. That's my balance. I work while I'm there, but I work on different kinds of things. So writing the book, that wasn't work. That was, you know, that was fun. Everything is fun. Most of the people that I know are business contacts, but there's still people that I go out and I have coffee with and I see them in the evenings, and they're friends as well. It's not a balance. It's an integration. I talked to my parents yesterday. Within 5 minutes, I was talking to them about work.
I guess as long as it doesn't bother you.
No. I mean, it might not be fun for the people around me. But I'm interested in lots of different things, but I can do them all at the same time. Everything is grist to the mill. Everything is information. Everything can be used either in work or in fun. And work is fun for me. I wouldn't do it if it wasn't.
PDSI's first public program focused on teenagers in the workplace took place on June 1st, and they plan to address more public-facing programs over the course of the year. That's all we have for you from our first live episode. We'll be sharing more details about our special summer season next week, so stay tuned. You've been listening to Tales of the Trade from Amaya FM with me, Chirag Desai. Our producer is Gaia. Our intern is Abhishek Venkatasubramanian. Original music for this show was composed by Rainer Erlings. A special thanks to Dana Al-Sadek and Infi for their support. You can subscribe to this show wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts, as well as streaming apps like Ngami and Spotify. You can also find us on Instagram for more updates.